So let's get started with the afternoon session. The first speaker of the session is Freddy Cacciasso, and he will speak about S-matrix theory.
Okay, thank you very much. Can you hear me? Is this okay? Excellent. So, of course, let me start by thanking the organizers for giving me the opportunity to speak here and for giving me the opportunity to visit such a beautiful city. So, as you may have noticed, I changed my title. The reason is that it was too long to fit in the transparency. So I decided to go for something more compact. Okay, so let me start by giving you an outline of my talk. Let's see if this works. Here is the outline. So it's going to be divided in three parts. And yesterday, J.J. Carrasco gave us, to the three speakers that are here from North America, he gave us a tremendous pressure, right? Because now we have to fulfill his separation of continents. And so my outline is the following. So in part one, it's going to be speculative, okay? Part two was actually my talk. So it's a precise calculations and results. And part three is actually going to be wildly speculative, okay? So part three, you can take it or leave it. Okay, so you're not forced to believe anything that I'm going to say there. So let's start with part one. But before we get to the speculative part, I have to start from something that we all know, which is the standard definition of the S-matrix. So we start with correlation functions computed by doing this path integral. So we have correlation function of points in space-time. So we are supposed to know about everything that happens in space-time. Then we take the Fourier transform, and based on general theorems, we know that this function is supposed to have poles, and we take the multiparticle residue, and the multiparticle residue turns out to be the S-matrix. Of course, you all know that this is a lie, right? Because Sever told us yesterday that this is a lie, because this definition assumes the presence of poles, and this can be formally proven for massive particles and not for massless particles. But here I'll be working in perturbation theory where this assumption is valid, even by Amit's standards. Okay. And needless to say, in the rest of the talk, I'll be talking only about massless particles. Okay. So the standard definition of the S-matrix computes it as a sum over all possible interactions that occur in the interior of space-time. So this is a Penrose diagram, or a simplified version of a Penrose diagram of space-time. And we describe the interaction of three particles going to three particles as a story of interactions that happen in space-time with Feynman diagrams. Now, Feynman diagrams lead to expressions where locality and unitarity are manifest. This is because they are constructed from local interactions of the theory, from a local Lagrangian. So locality and unitarity, which are the two pillars of quantum field theory, are made manifest in Feynman diagrams. But I don't have to say that to this audience, but I'll say it nevertheless, that since the work of Park and Taylor, and more recently all the explosion of activity sparked by Witten's twisted string theory in 2003, we have learned that there are other formulations of the S-matrix where locality or unitarity or both are not manifest, and they lead to spectacularly compact formulas. So is this a sign that manifest locality and unitarity are not the basic properties of a formulation of the S-matrix? Well, that's something that we have all been suspecting, and it would be nice to make it more precise. But how about more constraints? If we don't want to think about locality and unitarity, are there any things that we can replace those two constraints for? So another very strong constraint on the S-matrix, of course, is that it has to be Poincaré covariant. And this is a constraint that we impose on the asymptotic states, and we say that they have to be irreducible representations of Poincaré. Another constraint, which is very powerful, is that for massless particles, we also have Weinberg-Soft theorems, and they are represented here. We have heard several talks about this, so I won't go into details, but I'll just say that just imposing this condition, which relates different entries in the S-matrix, gives very powerful constraints on your theories. In particular, you can derive universality of gravitational coupling, electric charge conservation, no particles with helicities greater than 2. Basically, everything we know in physics can be derived using just the Soft theorems. But are there more constraints? Well, especially in the scattering of gravitons, one could be looking for symmetries of asymptotically flat spacetimes, and this is known as the BMS group. Of course, we all heard Pleshka's talk, and there are many details there that I won't repeat, but I'll just give you a one-slide summary of what the BMS group is. So in order to understand what the BMS group is, we have to understand the topology of future non-infinity or past non-infinity, and the topology is simply that of a real line times a sphere. Now, the sphere, we can think about it as a CP1, and there is an SL2C acting on the CP1, which is Lorentz transformations. Now, BMS realized that there is something much bigger than Poincaré, which is that you can take every point on the sphere and translate it independently, and those are called supertranslations. Okay? So we have two copies of this infinite-dimensional group, one at scribe minus and one at scribe plus. Now, could this be a new symmetry of the S-matrix? After all, the S-matrix is an observable defined at null infinity for massless particles. So if this is an operator that acts as BMS minus and BMS plus on scribe minus and scribe plus, then could it be that there is something like this where the S-matrix is inserted here? So this is the best that you can do as a commutator of the S-matrix with the BMS operator, or BMS operators. Well, but of course the answer is not. And the answer is no, because BMS plus and BS minus don't talk to each other, okay? And the reason they don't talk to each other is that they are separated. But Christodoulou and Kleinerman, they somehow resolve spatial infinity in such a way that a diagonal action of the BMS group is actually possible, okay? So from the 60s, we jump to the 90s, and now all of a sudden, we can define a diagonal action of the BMS group that connects past infinity, null infinity to future null infinity, and that gave Strominger the idea that this can actually be a new symmetry, and therefore you'll be looking for what identities, and they end up being, or some of the what identities of the supertranslations end up being related to Weinberg-Soft theorems. So this what identity, which corresponds to the insertion of a massless, of a soft graviton, gives this, which, as we saw, is precisely Weinberg-Soft theorem. Now, there were proposals that this can be extended to a full Virasoro, and then this leads to the proposal that there must be also subleading soft theorems, so you can find subleading soft theorems as well. But of course, I have to give you a warning here that this may actually not be the right structure, as Arthur told us. It may not be Virasoro. It might be something else. Good. So this leads me to the speculation. And the speculation is, can the S-matrix be determined purely from BMS representation theory? And so I'm going to give you the answer. And the answer is, probably not. But if BMS is extended, then maybe yes. So here are some hints. The hints are the following. In the past 10 years, we have come to realize that correlation functions on a sphere not only describe the string theory, but they also are very, very, very much linked to quantum field theory. And these correlation functions on the sphere might be connected to the BMS structure. And we also have developed techniques called on-shell diagrams, which basically get rid of all the interactions in space-time and replace everything, all the on-shell, off-shell physics that happens with Feynman diagrams and that comes from the correlation functions. All that information is replaced by only on-shell information. Okay? So these are two hints that maybe the answer is yes. Okay? So now we go to part two. So here are the hard calculations and then you're supposed to follow and get bored. Okay. Let's start with the description as spheres, as correlation functions on a sphere, or using a sphere as a way to describe scattering amplitudes. So let me start by describing what are known as scattering equations. We have heard several talks about this, But I'll give you just a simplified version of what it is. So this is a way of connecting kinematic invariance, or the space of kinematic invariance, to the moduli space of the M-puncher sphere. So these are two very different spaces. Here is a representation of the space of kinematic invariance. Okay, I've drawn only three axes, just because I ran out of ink. And then here, I haven't drawn the moduli space of Riemann surfaces. I've just drawn a point, a particular example of a Riemann surface with punctures. And the reason is that this moduli space is n minus 3 dimensional, so I wouldn't be able to do justice by drawing or attempting to draw what it is. Now, how do we connect these two spaces? Well, you might all be familiar with this function. This is precisely what appears in the Kovanilsen factoring string theory. So this is a function that is a function defined on this moduli space, and you might look for the critical points of this function, and the critical points of this function will then link the moduli space of punctures, or will give you locations for the punctures once you give the point in the kinematic space where you're living at. Okay? So we've heard also the story of this equation, so I won't repeat it. But what I want to say is the following. The space of kinematic invariance doesn't know any physics at all. It's just a boring space. So we have to enrich it by imposing unitarity and locality and telling the functions that we define there where they are supposed to have poles and where they are supposed to have branch cuts. In this case, this space, as I wrote it there, is a non-compact space and likewise doesn't know very much. But if you provide or you complete this or you compactify this a la Deligne-Mumford, then you are precisely providing the same information as unitarity and locality. Okay? Now, let's move on and say, well, we were talking about the constraints that Poincaré requires on the S-matrix. And now consider massless particles of helicity plus minus one. For simplicity, I'm restricting myself to four dimensions, but everything that I'm going to be saying is valid in general dimensions. And the scattering data for each particle is momentum and polarization vectors. And we all know that under general Lorentz transformations, choosing a polarization vector is actually completely the wrong representation for massless particles. In fact, the only transformation that we would like to get is the little group transformation, and all this part are all things that we shouldn't have. Okay? But, well, human beings only know how to describe things in terms of polarization vectors, so that's the best we can do. Okay? In general dimensions, say. Now, in collaboration with Song He and Ellis Yuan, we found a representation for Jean-Mills amplitudes that represent the amplitude as an integral over the moduli space of the M-puncture sphere. The integrand makes gauge invariant manifest, and the color structure, the UN color structure, also factors in a nice way that is very simple. So let me show you the formula. This is a formula that we have seen today several times too, but I'm going to describe each of the components one by one, and they match the corresponding colors. Okay? So let's start with the color structure, speaking of color. So in the standard color decomposition of UN, all the color structure that enters in Young-Mills for any amplitudes of gluons in any number of dimensions is universal, and it comes in this sequence of Taylor-like factors. So if you were in four dimensions and these sigmas were lambdas, or differences of lambdas, then this would be exactly a Taylor amplitude, and this is the object that encodes the whole color information. Okay? So this part is fairly simple. Now the measure, the part that I wrote down there, this is actually a shortcut or a shorthand notation for something a little bit more complicated, where you have to remove three punctured locations because you can fix them using SL2C, and you have to remove three equations because they are redundant, and there is some Fayette Popov Jacobian that you have to pay the price for. But the important point here is that these equations localize you to n minus 3 factorial points in the moduli space. So there are no integrals to be done. These are just algebraic equations that you are fixed and localized to those points. Okay? Now, the last piece. The last piece I find the most interesting because the last piece is the one that is supposed to carry the information of the polarization vectors. So it's supposed to be the one that makes Lorentz, that makes gauge invariant manifest, or that makes the Poincaré transformations manifest. So the idea is the following. We constructed this matrix that is written here in block form. In the first part, we only have contractions of momenta. Here, contractions of momenta with polarization vector, polarization vectors with momenta, and polarization vectors with polarization vectors. Okay? This matrix is anti-symmetric, and therefore it makes sense to compute the Pfaffian. If you don't remember what the Pfaffian is, all you have to remember is that every time you have an anti-symmetric matrix and you compute the determinant and you put it in mathematics and say factor, you always find a perfect square. So you just take the object that is a perfect square of and call it the Pfaffian. Okay? But now let's see why this matrix is interesting. So if you replace any polarization vector by its corresponding momentum vector, you see what happens? Let's go back for a second. Sorry. What happens is that two columns and two rows of this matrix become identical. So the rank of this matrix gets reduced. And if the rank gets reduced, the Pfaffian vanishes, because after all, it's the square root of the determinant. And therefore, you automatically get zero as a consequence of a trivial linear algebra constraint. Well, and remember that the polarization vectors are contracted with other vectors, and therefore, the Lorentz transformation that acts on the vectors is also gone. They are inner products, and that part is also gone. And therefore, the Pfaffian seems to be the basic object that transforms correctly under Lorentz transformations. In other words, when you apply a general Lorentz transformation, all you pick is precisely the little group transformation, nothing else. So that seems to be a very nice group theoretic object. How about gravity? Well, we found that a single Pfaffian transforms under the Lyrö group as an object that contains particles of helicity plus minus one. So the determinant must transform as something that contains particles of helicity plus minus two. So it's obvious to try an ansatz for the graviton amplitude that looks like this. So you remove the color factor that we had before, and we just put the determinant of this formula. Well, it turns out to be correct. Gauge invariant against is manifest. Okay. Now remember, before we had a single polarization vector per particle. When we square the Pfaffian, we're going to get two, and those are the polarization tensors of the gravitons. Now I'm not going to explain it today, but a nice property of this formula is that it makes soft theorems manifest, both in Young-Mills and in gravity. And these are the two ingredients that were important in the description of null infinity in BMS. So could this formula be telling you that BMS, or representation theory, is important when you are describing scattering amplitudes? But for that to be true, or to be generally true, it should also work for other theories, not only for gravity and Young-Mills. We know there are many other things. So here are some of the theories for which a formulation, a CHY formulation, is known to exist. Okay? As you can see, there are many different colors of theories here, so things that don't seem to be related at all. And then the question is, why are these the theories that appear? Why are they special? So these theories form a web related by some operations. Some of them are natural from the CHY formulation, but some of them are rather mysterious from the field theory point of view. Okay? So today, I'm going to tell you about one of the operations, which is actually natural from field theory, so that you can believe me. Okay? So this is just simple compactification. So start with GR. I told you that to construct amplitudes in gravity, all you take is a determinant. Now you can enrich this and put a B field and a dilaton, and the way you do it is by doing what the determinant wanted to do from the very beginning, to be two Pfaffians. But now you allow the polarization vectors in each of the two Pfaffians to be different. Doing so allows you to describe also dilatons and B fields. Okay? So I'm going to call this the left integrand and this the right integrand. And compactifying simply means that we're going to go from D dimensions, or capital D, to little d plus m. So we're going to go down to small d, so we're going to compactify m of the dimensions. What do we mean by compactifying in terms of operations down here? Well, it's fairly simple. You just take the big momentum vector and you put zeros in the last m components. Now I'm going to take the polarization vector on the right and do the same. I'm going to assume that they are completely contained in the uncompactified space and put zeros here. Now, for the polarization vectors of the particles, or the polarization vectors that appear on the left, I'm going to allow two possibilities. Either they are completely external, in which case you get a particle that is a graviton because it has two polarization vectors, and I'm going to call the set of gravitons by H, or you get something that is purely internal, and these ones are going to become the photons. So when you do so, the Fafian on the left, the Fafian on the right, if you remember, that has the epsilon tildes, is completely unchanged, and the Fafian on the left now becomes the Fafian of this matrix, where this is the set of gravitons and this is the set of photons. And you see that the matrix gets this block form, and the Fafian will split into two. Now, instead of explaining this general theory, which we could explain how it works and everything, let's just describe the case of pure photon amplitudes. Okay? So this is the case when you have only the scattering of external photons. But, of course, if we only had photons, the answer would be zero. But these are photons that interact through gravitons. Okay? So when we do so, and we go back to this matrix, we see that if these are all photons, this whole matrix becomes this matrix X, but we get a whole zero here and a whole zero here, and this is what is left over in this part. And that matrix, I'm going to call it A. Okay? A is defined as this simple matrix, defined in terms of the momenta, and X is this other matrix, which I've written one here for the case of a single compact direction, which means a single U1. Okay? Now, why is this interesting? Well, let's write down the full formula. So here is a full formula for the photon amplitude. And the reason this is interesting is that it has told us something else. It has told us that not only the Fafian of this matrix psi is a nice building block for amplitudes, but also the Fafian of this smaller matrix A and the Fafian of this smaller matrix X. They could also be used as building blocks for constructing theories. Now, recall that this Fafian and this C, which was the Part-Taylor factors that contains all the color structures, I call them half integrands. And the reason is that they carry half of the weight of SL to C. Okay, I didn't mention that, but that's the reason for calling them half. Now, how would you call Fafian of A and Fafian of X? Well, it only makes sense to call them, I guess, quarter integrands. So they are smaller pieces that you can also use. But what do I mean by using them? Well, what I mean is that it seems that any combination that you put here so that the total weight is 1, right? So these guys carry weight half, and these guys carry weight a quarter. If you combine them in such a way that you get something that carries weight 1, you might get yourself a new theory, okay? So you can start playing that game and see what happens. Well, what if we put here the Fafian of A squared? So what have I done? Sorry. I spoiled the surprise. So what I've done is replace this Fafian of X by another copy of Fafian of A. After all, they are the same. They carry the same weight. So I could replace them and ask if I can or play the game of having the S matrix of a theory and try to find the theory, which is usually the reverse game as the one that you play in quantum field theory in exams where they give you the Lagrangian and ask you to compute the S matrix. Well, I already spoiled the surprise, but anyhow, let me give you hints. This is a theory of interacting massless vector bosons with no color structure, but higher derivatives. The reason it has higher derivatives is that there are momenta contracted in the numerator. And what could this be? Well, it's a Bornfeld theory. Surprisingly, this simple object contains all the structure that is supposed to appear there, even the coefficients in the square root when you expand this out. So somehow this formula knows that this is special. Okay, I'll try not to spoil the surprise next time. Okay, here it is. Okay, I'll have to think about it. So, now I keep the Fafian A squared, and instead of the Fafian that we had on the right, I'm going to replace it by this color structure, this Part-Taylor structure, which seems to be something that I can also use happily. Okay? Now, hints for you. This is a theory of scalars with a UN flavor group and higher derivative interactions. What could it be? Well, if I was asked that question, I wouldn't know the answer. So you do what you do as a good supervisor. You ask your graduate student to compute lots of things and try to compute many, many terms in the Lagrangian as possible to construct a Lagrangian that reproduces these S matrix. And you find after, well, he finds after a lot of work that this turns out to be the chiral Lagrangian, or also known as the nonlinear sigma model. So this is a Lagrangian that describes the effective theory of pions. So, and it's given by this. So this is a complicated mess. Of course, we didn't get it in this form, but after some transformation, you can show that it's the same theory. Okay? So you keep playing. What else can we do? So the game seems to work every time. So how about replacing the color structure that we had there by another copy of Fafian A, but now square? The total weight is 1, because each Fafian of A is weight 1/4. And this is a theory of a single scalar with many, many derivative interactions. Okay? And it turns out to be very soft. What do I mean by very soft? What I mean is that when you take the soft limit, the weight vanishes as a power of the expansion parameter. It has a very high power of the soft parameter. So it's one of the softest theories that you can imagine. In fact, it's the softest one that I know of. Okay? So what could the softest theory be? Well, this turns out to be a special class of Galilean theories. These theories are described by this complicated Lagrangian. Okay? As you see, it has many, many derivative interactions. And it has many, many couplings. So at first, of course, we couldn't believe that it was true, because this theory has many couplings, and this object doesn't have any coupling. At most, it has one that sits in front, which I never write. Okay? But it turns out that these general Galilean theories, the general ones, produce S matrices that are soft, but not soft enough. If you want them to be super soft, you have to tune these coupling constants in such a way that they all become functions of just the first one, of G3. So all the other ones are completely determined by the requirement that this object becomes super soft. And that theory, when you do that matching, precisely matches with these S matrix. Last but not least, what if you combine the two color structures from one side and from the other? Well, this is a bijoint scalar theory, okay? A little complicated it looks here, but the object is not that complicated. Now, every time you have a color structure, you always think about doing a partial color decomposition. Now, if you're given two color structures, what do? Well, the natural thing, a double color decomposition, and you define double partial amplitudes. You take one element from here and one element from here. Remember that these dot, dot, dots mean permutations, and you take these two elements and one from here and one from here, and you define this object that depends on the two permutations that you have chosen. Now, this is something that is computed just in terms of cubic diagrams that can be embedded on a plane in a way that is consistent with the two orderings, alpha and beta. Okay? So you take your cubic diagrams and you put them on the plane, and you make sure that they are consistent with the two orderings, and the sum over such diagrams gives you the answer. Very good. There is another operation. This operation is completely strange from the field theoretic point of view. In fact, we have found no interpretation of this in terms of field theory, but it's very natural from the CHY description. But so that I don't get in trouble with you guys, I decided not to explain it in detail. Well, the truth is that I want to say something else, so we won't have time, or the formal version. The official version is that we don't have time to discuss this. But if you want, at the end, we can always discuss it on the blackboard. So this is a procedure for replacing a set of particles that possess S polarization vectors. So you take a bunch of them, and you replace them, or you squeeze them down, to a set of particles that contain S minus 1 polarization vectors. In other words, you can squeeze gravitons into gluons, or you can squeeze gluons into scalars. And every time you do it, you also stick in one of these factors that contain a single trace of UN. Using this, one can start with Einstein gravity and an amplitude of m gravitons and squeeze m1 gravitons into m1 gluons and produce a single trace interaction. But nothing stops you from doing it again, and you can take another set of gravitons, squeeze them into gluons, and produce another trace. And in such a way, you get double trace terms. These are extremely complicated amplitudes in terms of Feynman diagrams because you have two traces interacting through gravitons. So you have two groups of gluons interacting through gravitons. Okay? And this leads, if you keep going, this leads to all amplitudes in Einstein-Young-Mills. Okay. The reason I didn't want to explain squeezing carefully is that I want to squeeze in the KLT or the KLT formulation, but now in terms of the CHY formulation, okay? Or how to derive KLT from these CHY formulas. So we all know that the KLT relations express gravity amplitudes, or that's the standard way it came, as a sum of products of partial amplitudes, okay? So let's start with the gravitational amplitude, written in a way that also contains the B field and the dilaton. So the left integrand is just a Pfaffian, and the right integral is also a Pfaffian. Now, I told you that there are only n minus 3 factorial solutions, okay? I was trying to hide that fact, but I said it already. So there are n minus 3 factorial solutions, so this integral is nothing but the integrands evaluated on the solutions and a Jacobian. And I choose to write this as a vector, an n minus 3 factorial dimensional vector, I left, dotted with a matrix and another vector on this side. So the precise definition is here. So these are vectors, big vectors, and D is an n minus 3 factorial by n minus 3 factorial diagonal matrix given by this object. Okay, the diagonal components are just the inverse of the Jacobians, okay, evaluated at each one of the solutions. So this seems to be a little boring. And remember, you were supposed to be bored. This is a part two, okay? These are the hardcore calculations. So if you're bored, that was the intention. So let's, just for fun, also look back at these bi-adjoint scalar objects that we had before. So for any permutation alpha and beta, then the bi-adjoint theory gives you this formula. Remember, you have some ordering here, some ordering here, and I've just rewritten an extra power of the Jacobian. These two cancel if you want, but I've just, for convenience, for later convenience, put one power here and one power here, and put the inverse of this matrix right here. Okay? The reason I've done that is that I want to define this as a big matrix. Now it's a rectangular matrix of n factorial by n minus 3 factorial, and this one too. Okay? So these m's are going to be the components of a new matrix. Okay? It's an n factorial by n factorial matrix whose components are given by this. Now, it would be very nice if we could get from here what the inverse is or what the matrix D is, but there is no way to do it because you will have to invert this.